Rock to Recovery Radio. I'm your host, Wes Geer. This is Rock to Recovery Radio on KX93.5 FM. Brought to you also by New Vista Behavioral Health, partners that make this show possible. They have great treatment programs throughout California. Have a very exciting show tonight. So I always kind of talk about why we do this show. Why are we here? I'm a sober dude. I'm super passionate about recovery. Seems like every day we lose somebody else that we love or care about to mental health, addiction, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorder, something. We're always losing somebody. Every week. It's a bum out. Every day. And so this show is to bring light to a deadly disease, the deadly diseases, the ailments, the things that take people down. When we discuss them, it destigmatizes them. It supports people who are looking for help. It helps people know they're not alone. We can share information and we can share inspiration. That's really a key thing. When we're out there struggling, sometimes we feel like there's no hope. And here's what we do. We interview rad humans, celebrities, rock stars, people who have overcome these issues they've overcome their issues to thrive and have amazing lives and get into what I call, you guys probably know it by now, a couple of you do, the vortex of radness. That is what we're talking about here. What's the vortex of radness? The vortex of radness is when not only have you survived what was holding you back, but you're thriving and you're sharing so much amazing energy with people and your life and your life's work and the fulfillment of what you do and love. And it's, you know, you're sharing it between people and everything you do, that it actually creates this vortex that just keeps building and building and creating more of this incredible energy that you learn to love through your recovery. So tonight, our guest is, oh my gosh, I'm so excited. And we could have a whole week show on this one, I'm sure. I'm super excited about tonight's guest. So I'll set it up like this. Everybody's heard of Elvis Presley, for sure. I mean, it's the king of rock and roll, right? I grew up hearing Elvis from my parents, and I loved it. I loved Elvis's music. I loved hearing it. I loved growing up with it. And we all know that this is kind of like in the early days of fame and rock stars, and Elvis was beyond famous, bigger than big. Like he he had his own universe. He was defining the world of fame and everything. And along the way, Elvis's father, if I get this right, forgive me if I'm wrong, Vernon married a woman who I don't know the name of, but that is our guest's mom, if I'm getting this right. And so our guest is Elvis Presley's stepbrother. And from what I understand from their age difference, which is, I'm going to guess, around 20 years, and we'll get into those details in a second, Elvis was very much a father figure to this person. And this person, our guest, later became his bodyguard. Can you imagine? Can you imagine this life? And so our guest, and we want to welcome on the air, is, I'm very excited about this, Mr. David Stanley. Are you there?
Yes, I am. How are you today?
I'm good. Okay, I'm glad you're there. Welcome to the show.
Are you hearing me okay, Wes?
I'm hearing you good, man. I'm hearing you good.
Cool.
Yeah, it's your voice is music to my ears. How did I do? I know I didn't get it all right. I did. Tell me.
You did good. You did. It's kind of a strange situation. Elvis's mother died in 1958, and Vernon Presley was widowed. My mother and father, in 1960, when I was only 4 years old, went through a divorce. when my mother remarried, she married Vernon Presley, Elvis Presley's father. And I moved into the Graceland Mansion with my two little brothers in 1960 and lived there for the next 17 years. So Vernon was my stepfather. Elvis was my stepbrother. I didn't know what a hound dog was. I didn't know what a rock star was. I was 4 years old. I had no clue. I had come from a broken home. Suddenly I come up this driveway of the Graceland Mansion and come through the gates and up the driveway and get out of the car. And there stands a man 25 years old. This is March of 1960. Elvis had just gotten back from Germany because he was in the army for a couple of years.
Right.
And he was standing on the steps, and I got out of the car with my two older brothers, and there he was, and he picked us up, and he gave us a hug, and he welcomed us into his family. And that was an automatic bond. Elvis took us into his life when he didn't have to. He was very fond of his biological mother. Now suddenly she was gone, and here was this new stepmother with three sons. And Elvis welcomed us into his family and took us right in. And he was never anything but Big Brother from that day one.
That's amazing. Yeah, I mean, Elvis's first music was written for his mother, right? Some of those first songs. At least
well, he was, you know, here was a kid who was like 17, 18 years old who walked into a recording studio in Memphis, Tennessee to record a record for his mother for her birthday.
Right.
And suddenly that record became a hit. And they went back and recorded some more, and Elvis walked in a, you know, just a poor kid from Tupelo and walked out a king.
Yeah, that is incredible. That's incredible. Well, okay, so that's incredible. So so you were at Graceland a little bit of time before Elvis got home from the army?
We showed up in March, and Elvis got home in March as well, 1960. Mm. You're talking a long time ago now.
We're talking a long time
and
ago.
My mother had met Vernon. My mother's name B. Stanley. My mother had met Vernon Elvis' father while we were in Germany. My dad was stationed in Germany. Mm. And Vernon and D, Elvis' father, Vernon, and my mother, D, fell in love in Germany, and my mom left my dad. And we were pulled away from our father, and all of a sudden she remarried Vernon Presley.
Oh.
Like a fairy tale. It was, you know, and again, when you're 4 years old, you have no concept of what's going on. You got a guy that, you know, what was it like meeting Elvis Presley? What was really cool? Was he the king? He was just the person who welcomed me into his family, and that hug felt awful good after going through the confusion of a divorce with my family and not understanding what was going on. And that was the beginning of a surrealistic ride. I mean, you know, I spent 17 years with Elvis Presley. And I didn't really understand anything about him until I started to grow older in the first, second, third, and fourth grade. I got a lot of attention being driven to school in the pink Cadillac every day.
Oh, my gosh. And, driven to school in a pink Cadillac. What? So how old were you then? Was that like when you were 4 or 5, right at the beginning, right out?
Six, seven years old when I started school.
Right.
And, you know, when I go to school, I realized just how difficult it was going to be to live up to being his little brother, because sometimes Elvis would drive us off at school, and we'd go into school, and people would call us names and make fun of us. They were just jealous because our house was Grayson, and our brother was Elvis. But everybody wanted to spend the weekend at my house. You know, my friends said, hey, can we come over and spend the night? But everybody wanted to stay at Grayson.
I'm sure.
But it had a very profound effect on me, because at that young, early, and impressionable age, well, we all needed a friend. I didn't know who liked me because I was David Stanley or because I was living with Elvis Presley.
Yeah.
And that's where the rebellion began with me. That was the root of my rebellious acts as I grew older. And, you know, the drugs got involved in later in life, the rebellion that I went through against the establishment, against my family, you know, the whole nine yards. I was desperately trying to find somebody that liked me. And my only refuge was Graceland. And Elvis, again, was big brother and friend. I mean, the first day we moved into Graceland, he went out that night when we went to sleep at Graceland, and he bought a toy store, literally the contents of a toy store, and woke us up the next morning. My two older brothers, Ricky, Billy, and myself, went out in the backyard, and there was three toys that any kid could get ever want or ever dream of having. Wow. I didn't know what an Elvis Presley was, but I didn't know who Santa Claus was. I didn't know he had sunburns. I mean, it's a very surreal. It's a very unusual story.
Very unusual, yeah.
But it was cool, you know, being, you know, growing. I mean, it had its tough times, again, being made fun of, again, at that young and early Presley age when you're a friend. You had trust factors because you lived in this fishbowl called Graceland.
Yeah.
And your brother was Elvis Presley. And who's digging your chili because you're Presley's brother? or because you're David Stanley, and that was a very confusing time in my life.
So we're, and is this also like fans are hanging out at the gates, right?
Oh yeah.
So God, it's a spectacle, and this is your upbringing. I mean, you know, I had a little bit of fame, and I realized how much, especially for like an alcoholic brain like I have, it really messes with your head. So I feel like even though you weren't Elvis, right, being in that bubble of all these people freaking out, you know, that feel like they know Elvis, or maybe probably some of them felt like they knew you that didn't know you at all. Trying to get at you.
It's still that way. It's amazing that you were talking about Elvis's universe. He still has his own universe.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, there's two kinds of people in the world, the human race and Elvis fanatics. And they're like aliens, man. I mean, that group gets together. They rule the world. There's 20 million Elvis fans in the U.S. alone. I mean, it's amazing.
I mean, you know what? Elvis has an Instagram. I was doing my post today. I'm like, he has an Instagram. Didn't know that.
He's talking about a guy that's got 500 fan clubs in 49 countries. Yeah. I mean, a guy that sold over 1 billion records. A guy that's the most influential entertainer of the 20th century.
Yeah.
And to me, he was Big Brother. When I met him, I didn't know what a star was. Again, it's really important that people understand. I didn't look at Elvis and go, oh, that's not the best. I wasn't starstruck.
Right.
I was, hey, here's a guy. He's a big guy. He's kind of cool. He's like he just picks me up and walks me into his family. And that was the beginning of an unusual lifestyle. I mean, 17 years I lived at that house.
So you liked him. You had love for him. You had, like, your personal interactions were cool. They were loving, and you felt a bond there.
Very caring. You know, that's the character of Elvis. You know, he saw these three boys. Some would call us baggage. You know, Dee marries Vernon. You know, my mother marries his father, and Vernon could have been baggage. But Elvis looked at us and understood the situation here. Three young boys. 4, 6, and 7 years old, they have no concept of what they're even doing here. They have no idea what's going on. And that innocence, Elvis embraced us, and he took us in and understood that this is not choice, this is fate. And Elvis made a choice as a result of that fate to put us in his family and literally raise us as a father figure, as a mentor, as a friend, father figure, and advisor. I mean, he shared his life with us. I mean, I grew up on the back lots of the movie studios in Los Angeles. I fell asleep in more recording studios than you can imagine.
Yeah.
You know, '60s and all through the '60s and to the early '70s, and up until the day he died, I was a part of rock and roll history. I mean,
the biggest part.
And I don't look at it as I'm the star. Obviously, Elvis Presley was the superstar and still is. But, you know, being a part of that inner circle, that from as a member of Rock and Roll's first family, I saw a lot of things and saw a lot of history and had a lot of fun, but went through a lot of pain and loss when he eventually passed away, which we'll talk about later. But
I was
a person. He was a human being, and that's what people have to understand about when they hear about these individuals like Prince and Presley and you know, two kings and a prince we've lost, you know, Michael and... Yeah. These people are human. They're human beings with feelings. And you can understand that, Wes, coming from where
I totally get it. And you know, people, I've had fans go, how could Chester, you know, take his own life with all that he has? And it's like, you got to understand that, you know, when you're Chester, if he wanted to walk into a 12-step meeting or you can't do it. If you're Michael Jackson and you go, I want to go to McDonald's and have chicken nuggets, you can't do it. And you get very isolated, and then all these people, they're like, we love you. Everybody wants to say hi. Everybody wants to talk to you, and you're trying to be nice, and you just want to not have to talk to anybody. But if you don't, you're a jerk. And so there's all these people that think they know you through the music, but you don't know them at all. And you kind of have to pretend that you have love for them, and that becomes very isolating. And then, like, I love what you said, how you were saying, like, you didn't know if people liked you for you or for Elvis. So then you have trust issues. You don't know which relationships are real, and you get very isolated. And so,
well, that's the way it was with Elvis. And then, Wes, let me say that he, you know, he had a group of people around him. He was very family oriented, and he had a group of guys that he, you know, either grew up in high school with him or were in the army with him. You know, eventually they were called the Memphis Mafia, the traveling entourage, so to say. And those were handpicked people because Elvis did have trust issues. I can imagine. You know, we were just talking about who loves us because of who we are, because who our relationships are to. Imagine being Elvis.
Yeah.
Imagine not knowing who really wants the real thing. And I mean, and here's this innocent, shy young kid coming out of the South and open heart, trusting everybody, only to be burned and let down, and to realize how cruel the world could be. And then, you know, the other thing with Elvis that we want to make sure we don't forget to talk about is that individualism. Elvis had a twin brother that died at birth. Hmm. And Elvis always was that person who was, why did I survive the plane crash, so to say? Why him and not me?
Yeah.
And then add to that, the guy goes in and does a couple of records for his mom and becomes the biggest iconic superstar of all time. So he lived with the, I lost my brother, and then he got famous and he lost his mother. And then, you know, why is all this attention being given to me? Why does everything I touch turn to gold? Why am I this Midas touch type individual? Why am I blessed so much? All that starts adding up on an individual. Success can kill.
Sure.
And with Elvis, that lack of trust with people around him, so many people that he wanted to trust and he couldn't, the superstar nature. I mean, Elvis was a prototype. I mean, we got rock and roll bands and we got rock stars out there, but Elvis Presley didn't have anybody to go to.
Right.
Sit down and say, what's he going to do? Go to Frank Sinatra and say, what's it like being a superstar?
Right. It was, I mean, the beginning was the of prototype. Those famous megastars. There wasn't that many of them by then.
Right. Elvis was the first mm-hmm. big super rock star. Iconic star,
bigger than life.
So he was very bigger than life.
Yeah,
Elvis always used to say, "It's lonely at the top. It's lonely at the top."
For
but
sure.
I love that lonesome feeling. I'd look at it and say, "Do you? Do you love that lonesome feeling?" And obviously, he didn't.
Hmm. So let me ask you a question, though. I want to go back because we want to talk about David too, and I love all that you're sharing. Believe me, we love it. When you were growing up there, you had the presents coming, right? Okay, so obviously there's that part where you're like, okay, the toy store's here, and you got, you know, in the Cadillac, and some of it was feeling good. But let's talk about the part that started, like, the turmoil inside where you couldn't, you're at a young age. When do you remember not trusting people? Did you have kind of a resentment towards Elvis, or, like, I think you alluded to that a little bit, saying how... You could never live up to being Elvis.
Well, yeah,
so it makes it like, be kind of self-loathing and, wow, I'm just David here.
Well, that's a good point. Everybody wants to please their father. Everybody wants to grow up to be more successful than their father or their mother, so to say. And how are you going to be more successful than Elvis Presley? That really wasn't a big issue with me growing up. The biggest issue with me is going to school and somebody wanted to beat me up and they'd call me names and make fun of me.
Did that happen often?
It happened just about every single day.
Wow.
And it led to eventually I dropped out of school, you know, but those first second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth grade, I was running out of three schools because I couldn't get along. I was rebellious. Had a very serious problem. You hate me, I hate you.
Mm.
And a lot of bitterness, not toward Elvis, because Elvis was my refuge. I used to go home after school and say, Elvis, why are these people being this way? And Elvis could relate, because when he was in school, he was somewhat of a rebel and a, you know, flashy dresser. People used to beat him up and call him names, even before he was super famous. And he kind of related to that. He said, well, people are just going to be that way. People are cruel. So he taught me, you know, to just maintain, to embrace your faith, to maintain your integrity as much as you can, to strike back when struck at, which I did a lot and got me in a lot of trouble, which was probably not the best advice.
So you're fighting a lot.
A lot of fights, lots of trouble. My mom was sending me to a psychologist in the second, fourth, and seventh grade. That's when I was school. What's wrong with my boy?
And
what was wrong with me is I needed somebody to like me because I was David. Not because I was related to Elvis Presley. And it's probably not as bad as it sounds, but when you're, you know, 10, 11, 12, 13 years old, trying to find a friend, and certainly there were plenty of people who did like me for who I was, but the damage had been done in those early and impressionable years.
Sure.
And that rebellion, that, you know, that's, you know, let's smoke, okay, let's still drink and drink a cold beer, okay, you know, that identity crisis of trying to find yourself and trying to fit in.
Yeah.
Which is the tune for everybody who started in drugs or addictions somehow is more or less trying to get accepted.
Trying to fit in. Yeah.
Trying to fit in.
Well, right. So we talk about it from time to time. When you're a kid, you don't come preloaded with how to love and interact with other kids and how to be a son or a brother or a sister, or how you don't know how a father's supposed to be or a mom. You only have what you're exposed to. And when you get those damaging messages of people picking on you and fighting with you all the time, it's already tough enough go if you're just in a, quote, normal life. You're in those circumstances, then it can become a living hell. Absolutely. So when did you first get into smoking and drinking beer?
Well, that's, you know, you start getting into the, like, 7th and 8th and 9th grade. Let's smoke a cigarette. Okay, everybody else is doing it. The first time I smoked it, this made me sick as a dog. But, hey, look, David smokes. He's cool, you know. And, I mean, right. It's the broken record. We've heard the story. You probably hear from everybody that's worked with on your show. But the thing is, okay, I'll do this and okay, I'll do that. And a bunch of buddies said, let's go steal a pack of beer. We sat in the woods and drank beer. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't because it tasted good. It was because it was acceptance. It was a rite of passage, so to say, to be one of the boys, so to say.
Yeah.
And this rebellion went on and got worse and worse and worse. And, I mean, when I was 14 and 15 years old, I was a dangerous kid. You didn't want to mess with me because I'm a big guy. I was born big. You know, I became down south known as a badass, you know, because people would want a piece of me, and I got this bitterness and anger and trained myself to take care of myself. So I'm smoking, or if you popped off, I'd drop you. You know, I always seemed to get in trouble. And I used to go to Elvis and say, Elvis, what's the deal, Bill? Man, why are these people so mean and hateful and cruel? He said, David, tell you what you need to do. You need to drop out of school and go to work for me.
At like 15?
It's like 16 years old. Yeah. So by ninth grade, I finished my ninth grade of school in 1972, June of 72. I was said, drop out of school, go to work for me. I'll pay you $50,000 a year. And
how
mom
much?
Didn't raise no $50,000.
50 in what year?
1972, and I was 72. 16.
Wow, I didn't make 50 grand a year until I was like 1990, man. So that's probably a couple hundred. You know, that's like a couple hundred grand a year back then, huh? At 15 years old.
Oh yeah, with all the perks, we had our own jets, we had our own homes all over the world. We had the best hotels. With the perks and everything, it was even more than that.
What'd you say?
My mother, with the perks and everything that went along with working for him, it was worth more than 50. It was unlimited access.
You don't have to pay. But let's back up a second. So before you went on the road with him at 15, you know, you have that time from whatever you want to call it, 5 or 10 years. He's going out on the road. You're still trying to hang in school. Did you also, even though you were angry, right, with people giving you a hard time, did you also have a little bit of ego in there? Like, you know, hey, you know, I'm cool. I'm Elvis's little brother.
You know, I can honestly say I never did that.
I was not
brought up that way. Elvis wouldn't allow it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I got cocky. Yeah, you're reading me pretty well. I got a little cocky.
How do you not get cocky? Even if you're trying to keep it in control, part of you is going to go, I live in a mansion. I got endless money. I'm Elvis's brother. Look at our family, and you're some kid. And back then, you know, people had, like, you know, ripped jeans and holes in their shoes, and they would go to school like that.
Well, I would go to school like that, and I lived at Graceland.
I guess it was the style.
It was cool back then.
Yeah.
But no, I honestly, Wes, I wasn't brought up that way. I was brought up, Elvis was a very humble, never forget where you came from.
Mm-hmm.
And I was brought up in a Christian environment. My mother was always, I was in church Sunday morning, Sunday night, mm-hmm. Wednesday night, Tuesday, vacation, Bible schools, every church meeting you could ever imagine. And mm-hmm. Elvis really encouraged that. He thought that was a good balance. And at the end of the day, embracing my faith as a young person got me through. And in the years that I lived out, it still gets me through. But I could be cocky, but that wasn't the norm.
Yeah.
If Elvis told me being cocky, he would remind me of where I came from.
Yeah. So so you agreed to go on the road with him.
Well, this was June of 1972. There was the summer tour that Elvis would do about 4 or 5 tours a year, two Vegas acts a year, February and August, 60 shows for 30 days in Vegas. But we do anywhere from a 17 to 21-day tour, 21 shows 21 nights, 21 cities.
Wow.
And so
all private planes.
We had our own jet. We didn't know, Elvis, his entourage, and that was it. So June of 72, his first concert, my first concert, I had seen him in concert and started touring with him. My first day of physically working with him is Madison Square Garden in New York City. We got out of the car backstage, and I got out of the car. Now, I'll go back to what you said about being a little cocky. You kind of busted me a little bit. Here's where I was cocky. I got out of the car with Elvis at Madison Square Garden, inside the back parking way where you come backstage and drive up. And there was George Harrison.
George Harrison.
And I went over to George, and I said, "Hey, George, my name is David." That's when I was cocky. I'm Elvis's brother. It's a privilege to meet you. It's an honor to meet you, George. And I'm talking to George. And don't think for a second I didn't stop and look around at my friends and some of the guys that work for us. Excuse me, I'm talking to George.
Yeah, yeah.
So there were times, yes.
Sure. There's no way it's not going to get you a little bit. But, part of it, too, is when fans keep coming up. For me, my experience, even though I thought I was staying humble, as you start to see, you even said at the beginning of the show, not that you said it in this light, but there's Elvis fans are a different race of people. When you're constantly protecting, fans over there, this is the band, fans over there, this is the band, it starts building that segregation. When you see how crazy the fans act, it's hard not to get contemptuous, like you're knuckleheads and we're cool, we're the artists.
Well, there was a story that on my first tour that kind of relates to that. I spoke with George, took him backstage. He talked to Elvis, they hadn't met before. Elvis comes out on stage at Madison Square Garden. 20,000 flash bulbs go off at the same time. 500 old ladies rush the stage. 500 young ladies rush the stage. And, the most important thing to remember about me growing up with Elvis is I wasn't an Elvis fan.
You didn't like the music?
It was okay. I'd never buy it. I was the Beatles, the Stones,
Did you tell George, "Hey man, I'm not in this music either, but hey, I dig the Beatles"?
Oh, I told him. Meeting him was like one of the highlights of my life. And he went back and talked to Elvis. To make a long story short, before the show, Elvis said, "Make sure you take care of him." So I'm sitting next to George, and Elvis comes out. And it was more of a sense of pride, because I grew up with Elvis and I'd seen him in concert a few times. But when he came out and did the Garden, he owned that place. We did 5 shows in 2 days, broke all the records there. And then later we went from there to Evansville, Indiana. We're staying like at a Ramada Inn, one of the older hotels. A lot of difference between that and the Hilton Avenue of Americas in New York. And to go back to your story about being a big dog, I was trying to sleep one night. We had the top floor. The fans were screaming downstairs. "We want Elvis." I went out and said, "Shut up. I'm trying to sleep here."
Yeah.
One lady says, "Why don't you let me come up?" I said, "Okay, come over." Open the door, and there was this Elvis fan that looked like a circus act. She said, "Well, you said come up," and I said, "No, you better not. You better go." Make a long story short, I wake Elvis up the next day around 4 o'clock in the afternoon for a show. We're having breakfast in a suite, and he's mad at me. I said, "Well, what's wrong?" He said, "He's in the newspaper." I said, "What's the paper saying?" He holds up the newspaper on the cover of the Evansville Times. Elvis is stepbrother belligerent to fans. He got really pissed at me. Man. Oh, my God.
How'd you feel?
I said, "Elvis, I was trying to sleep, man. I didn't mean to be mean to anybody or nothing." But I learned real quick. You don't act that way on this tour. These are the fans. They pay the bills. They're why we're here. They're why we have that jet set over there. They're why we have the sold out arena.
That attitude, because there's so many rock stars these days, that attitude doesn't make it all the way around the world still. But hey, let's throw in the song now, because we got to put a little break in here. What's the first song that we're doing, David, that you picked? Do you remember?
Gosh, I don't remember. It's been a while. I think it was Midnight Rider.
Midnight Rider. You want to set it up? So we're in the chaos of what's going on, right? You're drinking, you're out doing tours now, making big money.
I'm out on the road with Elvis. By now I'm smoking, I'm blowing pot, getting high, drinking, doing my coke, and just embracing the world and everything. Yeah, because when I was 16 and 17 years old, I had access to the world, freedom from restraints of mom and dad and church and any authority. I was a hormone with feet when I was touring with Elvis Presley.
You were what?
A hormone with feet. I mean, girls were everywhere, you know, in excess everywhere. And I used to lay down and, like, I love the Allman Brothers. I've always loved Greg, and I love the Allman Brothers and Dwayne mm-hmm. back in the day. Mm-hmm. And Midnight Rider would come on the radio, and I just remember just going, you know, I got one more $7. I'm not going to let them catch me. No, I'm not going to let them catch the Midnight Rider. Mm-hmm. So that song is. Takes me back to being on tour with Presley.
Wow, that's amazing. So here we are. We're talking to David Stanley, Elvis's stepbrother, and at this point, bodyguard, I should say. This is Rock to Recovery Radio. I'm your host, Wes Geer, KX93.5 FM. This is Almonds. Yeah, here we are back. That song makes you feel good. I can imagine, though. I was kind of imagining being David in a hotel all messed up on, hopped up on goofballs, we used to say. Listen to that. Yeah, yeah.
Well, you know,
David, let me, hold on, sorry. I got to just do this really quick because I always forget. Sorry. Here we are back on KX93.5 FM. This is Rock to Recovery Radio. I'm Wes Geer, brought to you by New Vista Behavioral Health. And we are on the phone with David Stanley, Elvis's stepbrother. And we're talking about his story when his mom married Vernon, right? We said 61 when you're about four, was it?
1960, I was 4 years old.
Yeah, and then, and now where we are in the story, for those of you just tuning in now, is that he took the job with Elvis at about 15, going out on the road with him. So we're a few years deep in that, and he had just gotten in trouble for being drunk and yelling at a fan. It was in the newspaper. Elvis was not happy. And by this time, you said you're smoking weed, you're drinking, you're doing cocaine. And so somebody told me, and I won't out my source, and it may not even be true, but somebody told me that there was a time when, because Elvis was anti-drugs, right? Elvis walked in.
Absolutely.
Elvis.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well,
he would catch me, you know. I mean, I was like any other kid in high school, started blowing weed, you know, drinking my beers, you know, doing my thing. But so, when I started with Elvis, the excess that I had, he was very anti-marijuana or any kind of drugs for that matter, except for his prescription medications, which we'll get into later.
Right. I heard he walked in on you smoking weed and was pissed.
Oh yeah, he you know, he'd walk in and, you know, catch me smoking pot, and he'd go, you know what this would do to you. I mean, Elvis was Captain America. You got to understand, this is a guy in 1971 that went and saw President Nixon and said, we got to stop this drug problem in the U.S. You got to get John Lennon out of the country because he's ruining our youth. And I mean, Elvis was very Captain America. I mean, he didn't believe in taking messages to music and anti-establishment and drugs, lifting up the dangers of the drugs or the world. And, I mean, Elvis was a very simple, you know, Hound Dog was probably the most rebellious thing he did compared to when he heard the Beatles and the Stones and all that. He just went, oh, my God, we're going to lose our country.
Wow.
Because of the influence that it had on drugs. And I was a product of the Beatles and the Stones and a rock and roller. And so I'm, you know, I'm getting high, drinking my beers, cussing, smoking, chewing, lying, and lusting, so to say. And I, you know, I do a
thousand. Can you say that again, slow? You're what?
I get in a rhythm. I almost forgot what I said. I was.
It sounds like something that you said all the time, like you're chewing, smoking,
chewing, lying, and lusting.
I thought you were saying, wait, was cutting lines in there too?
Oh yeah, I was. You know, I had access.
Sure.
I mean, it was all over in the band. I mean, we didn't tour with the band. We had our own tour jet, and they had their own thing. But when the band was staying in the hotel where we were at after a concert, we'd just be partying all night. So, you know, when I think about listening to Greg and all the music that I listened to, you know, like I said, I did 1,000 concerts when I was president. And from 1972 to 77, we were all over the U.S. And the access was incredible. But the biggest problem that I had, you know, the access and being on tour with Elvis was exciting and fun and a rock and roller's dream. There's no question. Hanging out with the Stones and the Beatles and Zeppelin and Elton and all these guys. It was cool. The hard part for me would cause a lot of the addictions to get worse was watching Elvis, who went from a couple of pills to go to sleep to wake up to 2 to 4, 4 to 6, 6 to 8, 8 to 12, 12 to 20. And that use went to a casual, legitimate use went to abuse, all calling it legal prescribed medication, is ultimately what killed him. And, you know, and those years in 72 and 73 were great years in 74, but in 75, 76, and 77, it was one drug-induced day after another.
So
watching Elvis destroy himself was the most difficult part of my life so far.
I can't even imagine. So let's go to that. You guys are touring, you know, you're doing the debaucherous things. Elvis, you know, we were in the story, we're in like the early 70s. What point did he start doing pharmaceuticals? And I think it's really interesting because, you know, you think rock and roll, you think Bad Boys and all that. But I think it's really interesting, especially nowadays. Elvis was given a hard time for his dancing. It was too sexual. And now you were saying he's Captain America and was worried about the impact of drugs and that lifestyle with the Beatles and the Stones. So there's a guy with a good heart. But when did he start? When did he turn to drugs? What, he was just getting too worn out?
He actually started, he took his first drug when he's in the Army, called stay awake pills or bennies or uppers or Dexedrine, because they do field maneuvers and they didn't want you falling asleep out in the fields and freezing to death.
Right.
So he took stuff like that. And then in the late 60s, he'd take something to wake up or go to sleep. And when I started touring with him, he'd been taking medication quite a while. He had a little boy trust of doctors that eventually cost him his life, though, because, like I said, a couple of things to go to sleep, okay, a couple of things to wake up. And over the years, that intensified. And that use and casual legitimate use with the massive abuse. I mean, a typical night with Elvis in 76 and 77 was 33 sleeping pills a night, 9 shots of Demerol to go to sleep, counteracted by liquid coke and amphetamine to wake up. Every day.
That's insane.
Every single.
So when
you can see that, in 72 and 73, that was, we did Aloha from Hawaii, and being people saw it on TV.
I remember the concert. I watched it.
He weighed 172 pounds. When he died, he weighed 255, slurring his words, sweating profusely. Addiction grabbed him. Grabbed him and grabbed him hard. So, and that deniability that all addicts seem to have a part of, I need these. It's prescribed. Same with Michael. I need these prescribed medications. So Elvis wasn't the flagrant, rebellious, grab it off the street, cut it, and blow it. It was prescribed.
So ironic. He's telling you drugs are going to hurt you. Meanwhile, he's okay with some of the dabbling he did in pharmaceuticals from the Army. Like, he never put those in the same class. Like, you're smoking weed.
No, if it was prescribed, it was legal.
And that still goes on today. That still goes on today. And, some people
more now today than ever.
Right.
People legitimize it. They make it legit. It's prescription. And a lot of, his doctors, I mean, if Elvis Presley would have died last year, his doctor would be in prison for the rest of his life. I mean, his doctor got his wrist slapped and got suspended of his license for a couple of years. But, I mean, his doctor gave him the medications that cost him his life. Now, Elvis had to take him. He made the decision to do it. And it's hard for people to believe that Elvis had, I mean, back to the Elvis fan, they don't even believe it. Elvis would never do that. This guy was a Class A drug addict that made the wrong choice of taking prescribed medication, as many do today. Legal opioid abuse in America today is rapid because people, it's legit. It's I'm supposed to get it. The doctors give it to me. And back then, there was no accountability to those doctors doing it. And it caught up with Presley. We were canceling shows. I walked in, pulled him out of a half a dozen drug overdoses. That pressure on me intensified my medication.
And what were you doing at the time?
I was doing about 500 a day of coke, smoking weed, blowing.
$500 worth of coke?
A day.
So how much back then, how much cocaine is that? We're talking a half ounce or what?
About 5 or 6 grams.
5 or 6 grams a day of coke, and you're in your mid-20s?
Oh yeah,
and you're trying to hide it from Elvis.
Oh yeah,
and his whole band doing blow with you?
Not his whole band. There was a select group.
You guys hide now.
we did our thing, and my brothers were also on tour. My brother Ricky he really got addicted as well, and fortunately he overcame as well, but.
Well, it was new then, too. It was new. Like, cocaine hadn't been around that long then. You guys not only were pioneering rock and roll and rock stardom and what it was like to be jet set megastars, but pioneering the rock star lifestyle of cocaine and drinking all night. I mean, stuff was new,
Well, again, Elvis was the prototype. Being on tour with Elvis, you were touring with a king.
Did you know you had a problem at all? Were you like, man, because even for me, early on, I must have been 25. I knew I was having a good time. There wasn't a lot of repercussions yet. But deep inside, people would go, dude, you're going to die. And be like, yeah, I know, I probably will. I didn't care.
My situation, when I'd watch my brother Ricky, he really got into the Beatles and stuff, and thank God he's clean now, been clean most of his life. But when I'd like to think I didn't have an addictive spirit. I would see my brother Ricky go down, or I'd watch Elvis, you know, overdose half a dozen times. And every single time that would do something to me, that's not going to happen to me. I realized that had a problem.
Yeah. We all said that,
kept
right?
on saying that. Yeah, we all said. But for me, those reminders, I mean, the biggest reminder was on the 16th of August when I walked in the bathroom and there he was laying there dead.
Well, hold on a second. Hold before we get to there. Well, you said Elvis OD'd a half a dozen times. What is that times? What does that mean? And you had to cancel shows. So he's just passed out and you got to take him to the hospital. Did he ever die before? Did he have to be resuscitated? What did the OD consist of?
Mostly a couple of times he'd be eating food and he'd choke on his food and you'd have to do a Heimlich or
choke,
you know,
like
there,
fall asleep and choke, or he's kind of like half nodding.
Fall asleep and choke. A couple of times. Just overdoses where the doctors came in and put Ritalin in him and brought him back, or whatever, the adrenaline or whatever. I don't know what they did. They brought him back.
So the world had, I've never heard this, and there's probably other people that totally know this. I like to discover stuff in the show and whatever. But I think by and large, the world didn't know that Elvis was, this is insane. Like, he's like literally dying all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Before he actually died. I think that was hidden from a lot of people.
If he hadn't had his people around him, I know at least half a dozen times, if I hadn't have been there, he'd have died.
So are you blocking that out? Are you blocking that out from yourself? Like, you didn't want to admit how bad it was with Elvis? Like, why didn't you want to say something? Elvis, we got to stop this, or like...
Well, I did. I went up to him one night. He was sitting in his bed, and he said, I need my medication. I said, you mean these? And I picked up his pill bottles, and he put a 45 between my eyes and said, I'll blow off your freaking head if you don't put those down right now. And I looked at him, and I knew he wasn't going to kill me. I just looked at him, and I said, man, you've lost it. You know, he was dead 6 months later. I said, you've lost it, you know. And that pressure, I mean, you got to understand, man, I'm 19, 20, 21 years old going through this stuff with Presley. The self-destructiveness of Elvis, especially, was the biggest blow of my life. To watch a king who I admired and picked me up 17 years before totally self-destruct, that was, you know, there was a lot of deterrence that got me away from the medications and drugs that were costing me my health and life. But that was the biggest deterrent to watch Elvis destroy himself.
So you were going big, debaucherous lifestyle, and you knew Elvis had a problem and you wanted to get help. You just couldn't do anything. And then... that day happened.
Nobody told Elvis what to do. No one told Elvis what to do.
Well, and you know,
I wasn't the only one. There was many that worked with Elvis to try to put him in a situation to help him. But you've been around drug addicts.
Yeah.
I need these. You don't know what you're talking about. If you only knew how bad I needed this. And when you're Elvis, you don't. A 20-year-old kid does not tell the king of rock and roll what to do.
Right. And you know, I like it. And I know nothing about the inside of. Well, I won't use names. Other rock stars that I knew that have died. But you get around yes men, and nobody. And then if you do try to say, hey, man, I felt helpless with some of my friends who struggled where it's like, because I'm sober, I wanted to talk to them on that level that we can talk to now, you know, that and not been able to get at them. And it's heartbreaking because, you know, there's people around them that care. But they can't carry the message that we can, and it's a bunch of yes men. And it can be family. It can be family that doesn't know how addiction works. So,
well, with Elvis, he was so convincing that he needed them. But when you saw him gaining weight, slurring his words and canceling concerts and passing out and couldn't wake him up and overdosing, I mean, I was always very vocal about it. And, you know, after Elvis died, I was the first one to admit, hey, this guy died of a drug overdose. I mean, it wasn't a year after I was dead. I was in 2020 of ABC back in 79 or so. And what happened to Elvis? And I was the first one to say the guy had a very serious drug problem that cost him his life. Not a very popular thing to say about Elvis, especially then and now.
Nobody wanted to hear it.
That's, you know.
So how did that happen? What you want to tell us the story? You're not
well,
on tour?
Well, it happened. We were going on tour on the 16th of August. And I was getting some things ready, and one thing led to another, and I ran in his bathroom, and others had already ran in. The paramedics had already been called. When I came in, the paramedics were just walking in, and he was laid in a fetal position, face down. empty syringes, the pills laying around him. I knew what had happened. I knew he took too much. Now, the world says he has a heart, had a heart attack, but when you take 11 different kinds of drugs at one time, your heart's going to stop.
Right.
And he died. And I knew that. My first instinct, I was mad. I was mad at him. I said, you son of a bitch. You know, you did this. Because, see, Elvis had somebody with him all the time. We used to have to watch the guy sleep, setting the room and watch him sleep to make sure he'd be okay. And that weekend, he had his girlfriend with him. And no one was there. And he went into the bathroom a couple hours later when somebody walked in to see him laying there unconscious. When I walked in, I knew he was gone. Paramedics came to put him on the stretcher and carried him down the steps. 17 years of my life went down that driveway in the back of that ambulance. And it was over. We'd lost him. And that had a huge, massive changing effect in my life. I knew I was next if I didn't get it together. And let me tell you something, Wes. I was a rock and roller, crazy, wild-ass kid. But my addiction couldn't even touch Elvis. I mean, this guy was the worst thing you've ever seen in your life. And I don't say that to put him down. Nothing will take away the King of Rock and Roll's gift, no. His talent, and the impact that he had on the world. But I don't ever talk about Elvis unless I talk about the addictions that can cost your life. My book, My Brother Elvis, The Final Years, is about what we're talking about, the last 5 years of Elvis's life, and the tragic demise and death that took place as a result of his lifestyle. Numbers are in the back of the book where you can call and get help if you have got addiction problems. I use my platform of my relationship to Elvis Presley. If I can help one person, I've helped one.
Right.
If one person listens to my voice, read it or not read it, talk to Wes, call me, call somebody. But we've got to stop this issue, because if it can happen to Elvis and Michael and Prince and on and on, other people, it can happen to anybody. Wealth is not a substitute for real life. For what a man's profit is, he gains the whole world and loses his own soul. Elvis had it all, and drugs killed him.
That's right. It can get anybody. And, you know, there's that. I have to disclaim this statement by saying I'm not a doctor. People often need pharmaceuticals. Pharmaceuticals are often beneficial. But I've also had friends in that similar situation where I need the Adderall. I can't concentrate. I need the Ativan. I can't sleep. And we are a med-seeking society. It's programmed in our brain that, you know, Your eyes blink too much, you take a pill for it. Your mouth doesn't water enough, you take a pill for it. So, David, what helped you hit bottom? Obviously, I'm assuming after you lost Elvis, like, you know.
Elvis's death. I realized that I was back. And like I said earlier in the conversation, my mother brought me up in church. I embraced my faith at a very early age. And so I went from the King of Rock and Roll to the King of Kings. I embraced my faith, strong-willed, and overcame the addiction.
So how long after did your using get worse, or did you stop the day Elvis passed, or, you know?
Well, the first couple of years was the drug-induced blur.
Mm.
I didn't know where I was at after Elvis died. I stayed with friends and stayed wasted for 2 years. And then I just woke up one day, and my mom said, well, you know, you've tried God. I mean, you've tried the king. You know, well, you tried everything but God. I said, okay. So I just started praying and really seeking. And the images of Elvis's death and the image of what it did to him and the hurt that I faced as a result of it was more of this bad in my faith. Without getting deep, I'll just say my faith was the anchor that had helped me overcome the obstacles of addiction. And since 1980, I've been a speaker for over 30-something years in high schools and colleges and rehab centers and associations. In fact, I'm going to be in Anaheim, California, September 19th through the 21st, 2018, for the Western States Opioid Summit. I use my path.
I'll see you there. I'm going to be there, too.
Yeah, I'm speaking there. So, yeah, we'll hook up.
Yeah, I can't wait. I want to see you.
September 19th through the 21st, 2018 in Anaheim.
Well, I love that what you're talking about, and this is what I think a lot of people miss that are working on recovery today. In the early days of recovery before rehabs, what people did is they got sober and they instantly went out and looked for other people to help. And when you see somebody else who, even if you have a week or two, if you see somebody else who's struggling, who has 0 days or trying to get the first days, it really helps you stay sober because you don't want to go back. Now, you shouldn't do that work alone. You got to be with somebody with good recovery because it's too dangerous. Very too dangerous. You need to make sure you have a sober crew if you're going to go, trying to help people. But my point is, we turn this into our life's work. Part of our mission, at least, is to help carry the message that, hey, there's another way. There's a way out. Well, I can help you.
We survive for a reason. We can use it as a platform. Your celebrity status, you're well-known, you're respected. People know who you are. Same with me. I'm no king. I'm just David Stanley, but I have a message. I lived with the king. I grew up in that environment. I'm part of rock and roll history. I use that as a platform to communicate what's good. I've written books about it. I speak about it. I'm looking forward to being at the summit in Anaheim in September. Looking forward to meeting you. But my thing is, we went through it for a reason and we survived it. And that survival mechanism of me is nothing more than a perpetuation of my faith and how I overcame it.
And thank you for sharing that. And now let me ask you something, because if your answer is the same as mine, well, I think it is the same as mine. You had this life with Elvis, which, I mean, you love this is your brother. I get that. The fame and all that amazing stuff. But now check this out. Isn't there, not that you ever wouldn't want Elvis to be back in your life, but isn't there something special and beautiful about this part of your sober life that you almost wouldn't trade it for anything?
I wouldn't trade it for anything. I've been given a life and a platform to communicate a good. And, I miss Elvis. His time, he went and came like a flash that he was, and he'll never be forgotten. And I wish it hadn't happened the way it did, but it did. And my faith embraces where he's at and what he's doing, and I'm grateful for that. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't trade my life for anything right now. I think somebody said, if Elvis called you today and said, let's go on tour, would you go? Yes, I'd be different, but I'd still go.
But that's a huge statement, and the reason I ask is because that's how I feel. I got to do the debaucherous rock star thing, like you're saying, excess, endless everything, and the fame stuff and all this stuff. And you know what? This, and I hope that people are listening at home. By the way, this is Rock to Recovery Radio here with David Stanley. I hope people listening at home believe us when we say, I would never trade. And I had some good times out there in my non-sober days. I would never trade the sober life I have, the fulfillment, the joy, the purpose, and these natural highs I get for anything. And David, you agree, for anything, any part of that get loaded.
And I've had everything.
Right.
And I wouldn't trade it for anything, and I've had everything.
And that's a huge statement. David, we're out of time. I'd love to talk all night to you, man. I'm going to get your number, and we're going to talk soon. But I got to close this up because we're on radio time. This is David Stanley on Rock to Recovery Radio, Elvis Presley's brother. My name's Wes Geer on KX93.5 FM. This has been Rock to Recovery Radio, brought to you by New Vista Behavioral Health. David, I love you. We'll talk more soon.
Love you, bro. Bye.